Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. 22 very lucky people are going to have the opportunity of a lifetime next year from May the 10th through June the 3rd. Actually, May the 19th through June the 3rd. I beg your pardon. I misread that. When they go on a study abroad experience to various sites on the European continent in a history class titled Warfare and Public Memory in Western Europe. Various sites that are important in the history of the Second World War will be on this 16-day tour, including, of course, Normandy, but also Bastogne, Dachau, and Hitler's retreat in the mountains at Berchtesgaden. And one of the paramount people involved in this, as a matter of fact, it was his brainchild, Dr. Derek Frisby, will be leading the group. He's an associate professor of history. He has already escorted students to several World War II sites in the Pacific Theater, and now he's going to examine the European experience of World War II with students and faculty. And Derek, thanks for being with us again, first of all.
Oh, my pleasure, Jenna.
And secondly, even though you're going to these various sites, some of which are battle sites, some of which are important for other historical reasons, you're really going to be looking at World War II in a more holistic sense, aren't you, in terms of the type of warfare that occurred on the European continent for centuries prior to the Second World War?
That's correct. We have a very important opportunity for our students to be able to study these battlefields, and more importantly, how the public remembers these battlefields. We're going to talk about military history. We're going to talk about the innovations in warfare from 1066 with the French invasion of Normandy, or from Normandy across to Great Britain, but also as the Allies in World War II came through and swept through Western Europe to liberate Berlin. So we're going to study all aspects of war, but also how people remember that war. And we're going to have another exciting opportunity to visit places where MTSU alums served and fell during these wars.
There was one in particular, a point at which a plane carrying an MTSU alum crashed.
That's correct. We know that MTSU alum Robert Sarvis was actually a Canadian by birth, and when the war started, joined the Royal Air Force, was on a bombing mission, and was jumped by German fighters on the return trip home. And the initial reports were that the plane went down over the channel. We know that from the survivors of that aircraft, the pilot, Robert Sarvis, made sure that everyone else got out of the plane and stayed with the plane until it was too late for him to save himself, and the plane crashed. In the course of constructing the MTSU Veterans Memorial, we were contacted by some Englishmen living in France who heard about the memorial, believe it or not, and said that they had located the crash site of Robert Sarvis, and it was not actually in the channel. It was in the town just south of Saint-Mère-Aglis behind Omaha and Utah beaches in France. They knew where the crash site was. They had pieces of the plane, I believe, on display at a museum there.
It was a
B-26. B-25, I believe.
25.
B-25 Liberator. And in the course of building a road in the last few years, they had uncovered more parts of the plane as well as human remains, and those were identified as Robert Sarvis. So we've made contact with the individuals in the town in France where the crash site is located, and we're going to visit them and have a reception to remember Robert Sarvis and the incident there in that town, because it is part of their historical memory, this plane crashing in July 1944.
That's really extraordinary that you could put the MTSU tie and the MTSU connection into this trip and to integrate it into the curriculum. That's truly an extraordinary thing.
It is extraordinary, and I'm so excited to be able to do that, just as we were last year on, or the last couple of years on Iwo Jima, Guam, and Peleliu.
And the difference between the Pacific Theater trip and this trip, well, there ought to be some obvious differences, climate, topography, and everything else. But what are some of the other differences?
Well, just from a Just from my perspective, the logistical challenges are actually greater in Europe, believe it or not, than they are in the Pacific. In the Pacific, we were on American territory in Guam. Peleliu, the country of Palau, where Peleliu is located, uses the American dollar. There was very little communication barriers or even currency exchange barriers to this. We only had one hotel on Peleliu, for instance, so that makes the reservation process a little easier. In Europe, we're going to be gone for 14 days, staying in a number of hotels in multiple countries with language barriers. And fortunately, we still do have the euro as a single currency, but dealing with currency exchange rates and things has been an interesting experience. And plus, we're going to take a larger group. We're going to almost double the size of the groups we take to the Pacific. So from a logistical perspective, it's a different experience for me. But I'm just so thrilled to have the types of students and the type of individuals going with us who have relatives who served in these conflicts, and to be able to have not only the ties that of MTSU veterans, but also other work we've done. We're going to be visiting the Alvin York site that Tom Noland, a colleague of mine in the Geosciences Department, as well as another colleague of mine, Michael Birdwell at Tennessee Tech, did extraordinary, again, research on locating the Alvin York battlefields from World War I. So we're gonna go there as well.
This is the site where Dr. Tom Noland from Geosciences used GPS to investigate the site where Alvin York from Pall Mall, Tennessee, in World War I supposedly virtually single-handedly captured an enormous number of German soldiers.
Over 100 German soldiers he was captured, credited with capturing, as well as taking out scores of German soldiers with his marksmanship abilities to save his unit. And that battlefield went almost unknown for long periods of time. It was almost forgotten.
Even though it had been immortalized in the movie with starring Gary Cooper and everything else.
That's correct. And so thanks to the Geosciences Department and the research that Dr. Noland and others did, we now have the opportunity to visit that location. And I think that's important for the students because I think one of the draws of this trip is it is largely retracing the route of the 101st Airborne Division, which is just north of here in Fort Campbell. And many people have seen the Band of Brothers or the Saving Private Ryan films. I think it's important for people to not only make those connections with those dramas that they see, but to understand how history is made and how history sometimes differs in Hollywood than it does in these actual locations.
The route of the 101st Airborne Division's Band of Brothers includes tours of Arnhem and the Battle of the Bulge site, and tours of Omaha and Utah beaches that were important in D-Day in France, as well as the Bayeux Tapestry. You're going to go to Paris, Verdun, and Waterloo.
That's correct. Yeah, we're even going to visit the site of that famous Napoleonic Battle of Waterloo. So we're going to get multiple centuries of warfare.
And Verdun, which was important in World War I, too.
Verdun was a tragedy on a scale that's almost incomprehensible to us today. Mm-hmm. We had over 750,000 casualties in that conflict on both sides of the fighting, and the United States wasn't involved in it yet. But the devastation is still visible on the ground today, and they have an amazing memorial there called the ossuary, in which the remains of many of these soldiers are still clearly visible in the mausoleums there. So it's just an extraordinary trip, and I'm just so thrilled to have the types of students and the number of students that we have on this trip.
We started promoting this in October. You had probably talked it up in the halls long before then. Were you surprised to get as many as you did?
I was a little bit surprised. Being a Marine myself, I was always more interested in the Pacific, and I'm fortunate that I was able to make those trips.
Just to clarify, you didn't serve in the Pacific.
No,
theater.
Right.
You served in Desert Storm.
I served in Desert Storm, but obviously, yeah, the Marine history in the Pacific is a strong one, and so it was important for me to visit those sites. The trips to Europe, I'd been to Europe several times before, earlier, both in high school and in college, but I wasn't quite sure that we could make the European trip work from a logistical standpoint, to make it at a price point in which students would be able to afford. But we were able to make that part of it work, and the rest of it just came together. The students sort of signed up pretty quickly, and we've actually had to turn people away. I say turn people away. I feel pretty confident we may be able to do this again you know, in 2012.
In the same time frame?
In the same time frame.
In that same May to June or May to July
time frame. That's what we probably shoot for. That's really the beginning of tourist season. If you wait any later than that in Europe, I hear it's kind of a...
a zoo?
A zoo.
Price, just to go back to that again, now we try to do everything as cost-effectively as possible at MTSU, but even more so in these tight economic times where everybody is strapped. But for in-state tuition, $800 for an undergraduate, $1,150 for a graduate, and a $75 study abroad application fee and travel insurance for an approximate total of $3,500 a student for the whole shebang, including transportation. That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to, with tuition, probably end up being about $4,000 for most students. But yeah, I think it's a really good deal. I mean, that includes your transportation, that includes breakfast in the hotels, that includes admission to the sites that we're going to visit, and I think it's just a fascinating trip, and I'm again, so thrilled we were able to do it, and I'm really looking forward to it.
How did you decide on the order that things would take, that the itinerary would take? Are you doing a chronological timeline, or how did you sketch it out?
Well, in the World War II sense, we tried to do it as chronologically as possible. Ideally, when we wanted to do this trip, we wanted to start in London and actually make a ferry crossing, much like many of the soldiers did when they landed on the beaches at Normandy. That isn't necessarily, again, logistically possible. So we decided just to fly into Paris and sort of drop in, as the 101st did, into Normandy behind the American sector, and start with the Bayeau Tapestry, because in 1066, as William the Conqueror crossed over into England, we started with that invasion, and then we're going to start in Normandy with the Allied invasion, Operation Overlord, and begin tracing the steps of the Allied liberation of Europe. That great crusade that, as Eisenhower called it, from Normandy down to Paris, into the Alsace-Lorraine region on France and Germany's border. We'll be able to visit the World War I sites there, of course, and then move up to Bastogne, the Battle of the Bulge areas, and into Operation Market Garden, which is often lost in a lot of the history of the war. People forget that in September 1944, not only was the United States attempting Operation Market Garden in Europe, they were also invading Peleliu. And so it's a very busy time of the war, and it often gets sort of lost in between the invasion of Normandy the previous summer and then, of course, the drive to Berlin and Bastogne.
It stops along the way in France for a little diversion at the Cathedral of Notre Dame and the Louvre. While you're at the cathedral, say hello to Quasimodo for me. He's a cousin of mine.
Well, I hope to visit the Paris Opera. Maybe I'll see the Phantom there, too.
Okay. The really serious part of this for, I think, anybody would be the part that is most directly associated with the Holocaust. And you have the group scheduled to go to the grounds where the Nazi Party rallied, and the courtroom where the Nuremberg trials were conducted, as well as Dachau. Talk about what kinds of emotions run through you when you think about that.
Well, first of all, when we planned this trip, there's really no way to talk about World War II in Europe unless you talk about the Holocaust. MTSU has always had a strong Holocaust studies program, thanks to Dr. Nancy Ruprecht. And you would be remiss not to allow students that experience. Dachau was the first concentration camp that I visited when I visited Europe for the first time as a teenager. It was a very powerful and very moving experience, and I knew that when we planned this trip out, we would have to make a stop there to give our students that same experience that I had when I first visited many years ago.
And then Berchtesgaden, Hitler's Austrian retreat. If you watch the History Channel at all, I'm sure you've seen documentaries in which a lot of the color 35mm film of Adolf and his minions, as well as Eva Braun, cavorting up there while getting a view of the Austrian Alps. Mm-hmm.
Berchtesgaden is a wonderful place. I'm going to go back and talk about Nuremberg, too. I forgot to talk about Dachau. The Nuremberg experience is another aspect of that Holocaust program, obviously, where it's important for the students to understand the moral and ethical conflicts of war. Mm-hmm. I think the Nuremberg trials would do that. And you know, as you mentioned earlier, almost any World War II documentary that mentions Adolf Hitler will show films of the of Hitler with the Austrian Alps in the background. And we wanted to make sure that our students had the opportunity to visit that site. It's my understanding that the actual home or chalet where Hitler lived is no longer standing. There's a basement there with trees growing up through it. But many of the vaults and things that held the hidden art, the stolen artwork that the Nazis had, and a number of other items, as well as sort of the main retreat location, is still visible. So it's a very arduous trip to get there. You have to take a special bus, and they only make that trip usually once a day, and it has to be good weather conditions. So hopefully we're going to be right there at the beginning of that good weather to make it up there to that location. And I think that's a really great place to end.
It would be June?
It'd be June 2nd or 1st or 2nd. We'd be up there.
Yeah, well, you ought to have good weather for that then. And then you fly back to Nashville from Munich.
That's correct.
And with regard to a trip like this in both France and Germany, but especially Germany, talk a little bit about how those countries, from the standpoint of the tourist trade, attempt to project history. The lens through which one views history is important, and who's operating the camera, so to speak. How do the French and the Germans tell this story, respectively?
Well, I think that's what we want our students to investigate. I don't know that I have any sort of preconceived notions of how they do this. From what I've seen so far, I think there is a tourist industry in some of these battlefield areas that will cater to the American perspective on the war. And what we want our students to investigate and to explore is, do these areas portray the war differently for Europeans than for Americans? Are these tourist sites geared largely for American tourists or for European tourists? It's not uncommon to see, you know, obviously Americans from North and South visit Civil War battlefields, but do you have Germans visiting, say, Normandy? Do you have Germans visiting Arnhem and Bastogne? Do they view are the interpretations of these battles different depending on whether you're what nationality you are, German, French, American, or British? And that's something that I'm interested in. In the Pacific, those areas are national park controlled areas. We know that Iwo Jima, which we went to in 2009, is not a tourist site, so there's not a lot of interpretation there, but the Japanese do provide some. How they view that location as compared to the Americans is an interesting sort of comparison. And I want to be able to look at how they do the same thing in Europe, and I think it'd be a very interesting perspective.
From what little I've read, I understand the Germans are particularly sensitive about how the Nazi party and Nazi symbols are depicted.
That's correct, and that's one of the reasons when we visit Nuremberg, not only are we going to the Nuremberg trial locations, but we're also going to what's known as the Nazi party rally grounds. Again, any sort of documentary on the Nazis in World War II, you see these mass gatherings and conventions, and these were normally done in Nuremberg, which I believe Hitler actually said was one of the most, was probably the most German city in Germany. So how do you portray the Nazi party at a location like this when there are actually legal restrictions on how you display Nazi symbols in Germany? So I think that's going to be an interesting visit for our students to make.
Why does World War II continue to fascinate generation after generation all these decades after the fact, with as many documentaries as has been done about it, and as much dissection of Adolf Hitler's childhood, psyche, sex life, and speaking ability has been done, both by professionals and amateurs? One might ask, what more is there to delve into about World War II?
Well, every generation has their own interpretation of these events, and history is a constantly changing set of interpretations and perspectives. Knowing the facts is different than the history itself. History is really what I think what Napoleon once referred to as lies agreed upon. So every generation tells its own set of lies and creates its own story. And we want to see how that's changed over time. We know that a lot of our students get practice in this in the Civil War, what we call historiography. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that World War II, I think, fascinates people is that we are living in a time in which we will have to write a new history of World War II. That greatest generation is sadly leaving us at a pretty quick rate. And they were able to sort of tell their stories orally in interviews and in video recordings. And now it's going to be up to a new generation of people to try to remember that war, and how we craft that story, how we interpret it, will be important for the next generation.
You touched on Hollywood. Certainly any number of movies and miniseries have been made about various aspects of the war. Do you have any idea, just, well, not this particular bunch because you haven't taken them yet, but just from the classes that you've taught here, generally speaking, do your students come into your class with a sort of Hollywoodized celluloid vision of what World War II was like?
I think they do. I think Hollywood, because it is sort of a compressed time frame, a lot of them believe that the battles were almost constant, taking place minute by minute. I don't think that they understand the distances and the terrain involved in this, and sort of the old military concept of hurry up and wait. Combat really is sort of extreme boredom punctuated by mm-hmm. by moments of extreme excitement. But I think it's important to get on the ground, and I think that's what I've tried to bring to our military history program, is that it's one thing to read about war, it's one thing to sort of study war, it's another thing to get out on these battlefields in the environment that these soldiers fought in and get a better sense of what not only the motivations for these men were, but also what the consequences were for them.
How well preserved are these battlefields? Do the Europeans preserve their battlefields as meticulously as Civil War aficionados try to preserve those battle sites here in America?
Well, I think it varies from location to location. Normandy is still, I guess what you would say, fairly pristine in terms of its battlefield protection. There are still bunkers and casemates and things around with guns, and most of the guns have been salvaged after the war, but some of those guns still remain. Parts of the Atlantic Wall still are in place. But when you get in towards Paris and you get in some of the more urban areas, especially around Arnhem, I think, like Murfreesboro, you see a lot of the battlefield has been sort of encompassed into the community, so it's a little bit more difficult to maneuver. But I think it varies from location to location. I'm really excited to see what they do at Waterloo, to see how that battlefield 200 years after the fact is remembered, as opposed to, say, places like Normandy, which are 65 years past.
It could have been extraordinarily modernized over time. I hope much hasn't been left or paved over by developers.
Yeah, well, it's just outside of Brussels, Waterloo, so I'm interested to see how that works.
So you won't be taking in NATO headquarters while you're in the Brussels area?
No, we do hope to. They're actually, we located, in the course of planning this event, we located a NATO museum just outside of the Fulga Gap, which was a very important strategic choke point for NATO forces should the Soviets ever invade Western Europe. We're hoping to hit it. I don't know if we'll make it in time before it closes that day, but it's what we call a target of opportunity for us. Maybe we'll get a chance to even see how they interpret the Cold War in Germany.
When you, in your study abroad experiences as a professor taking students to Peleliu and Iwo Jima and Okinawa, what is it like for you to, of course, you're responsible for, we don't have in loco parentis anymore, but in effect, as a representative of the university, you're responsible for these young people and their welfare and their well-being. What is that like, knowing having to make all the logistic arrangements, fulfill all of the responsibilities that you have to do and teach a class and make sure everybody stays safe all at the same time. Do you get to have any fun?
Oh, yeah, I have plenty of fun. This entire trip is my idea of fun. We've had really good experiences. In the Pacific, we've never had any trouble with our students. They know our study abroad program does a tremendous job instilling into our students that wherever they go, whatever time of day it is, whether they're in sort of class, as we would say, or on some free time, that they are student ambassadors for our university. And I think they all realize that, and they've all done a good job of accepting that responsibility and behaving as we would want our university to be represented.
Are most of the students who have signed up for the European excursion history majors?
Some of them are. Some of them are joining friends that are history majors. I know that we have one history major whose grandmother is going to join him. And we know that we have some students, graduate students, undergraduate students from various majors going along with it. So I think it's an interdisciplinary group, and everybody's able to bring something to the table and really enhance the class for everyone else. I mean, yeah, I think it would be a shame for just to have me be the tour guide. And the way we've tried to structure the program is to let the students be tour guides. We've in the past assigned students sectors of battlefields to sort of give briefings on for the rest of the students. Mm-hmm. So we've tried to let the students do as much as possible and allow the faculty just to sort of be mentors and observers in this process.
With the student who's bringing his grandmother, did grandma or grandpa, either one, were they in the service during the war?
I believe his grandfather was. I'd have to go back and double check on that. But I think there's a connection for both of them there to be able to make this trip.
Have you visited the World War II Memorial in Washington, which is one of the relatively newer monuments in that monument-filled city?
Yes, I visited the World War II Monument. That was another sort of very challenging public history monument. There were a lot of people that were opposed to that monument being on the National Mall and how they integrated that into the mall and the landscaping there. Is an interesting story in itself. Mm-hmm. But we've been to the memorial. I don't know, for people who haven't been there, there's a Pacific side and a European side.
And a fountain in the middle.
And a fountain in the middle. So,
what did you think of it aesthetically?
Aesthetically, I think it's very nice. I mean, I don't think it's too audacious, and yet I think it's appropriate. I mean, you have to understand the scope of World War II is almost, it's unlike anything we as a nation has really ever attempted. So to be able to encompass so much in that restricted space is really an amazing testament to the passion of the people that were involved in that project.
What will enable you to be able to offer this very same European study abroad experience in 2012?
Well, the first thing that dictates the return trip is the euro, the exchange rate. As long as the exchange rate stays below a certain perspective, the price remains relatively stable. If the euro rate changes, then we'd have to adjust the price of the trip. And we have to have a certain number of people go to make it financially acceptable in order to get group discounts at hotels and to make the bus trip work. Then we need, a certain number of people in order to be able to make the trip. But I think this year we could have gone with a larger group had we chosen to do that. This being our first year of doing it, we decided to go with a relatively smaller group just to sort of see how it would work. And then next year we'll make another attempt at it and see if we can get more people to go with us.
Now, the group is full for this time.
We have a waiting list, and we have one or two people right now who've decided they wanted to be on that waiting list. But I feel pretty confident that we'll have 22 people going with us this year.
Everybody's pretty much set on going, and you don't anticipate anybody dropping out at the last minute or anything like that?
Not at this point. I'm sure that always happens, but I would love to hear from veterans. I would love to hear from people that might be interested in going next year so that we have a better handle and can get this trip started.
Now, if you want more information about the trip, Derek's email here at MTSU is dfrisby, that's D-F-R-I-S-B-Y, at mtsu.edu, or you can call his office number, which is, I believe, 615-904-8097. You also have a link to a web page that will tell you all about the World War II European trip that is scheduled for to begin on May 19th, 2011, at your website, which you go to mtsu.edu/tildedfrisby, and there's a link right there that'll take you to it. It will tell you everything that you want to know. Thanks for being with us, Derek.
Oh, thank you so much, Jenna.
Dr. Derek Frisby, Associate Professor of History. I'm Jenna Logue. This is MTSU on the Record. Be sure and join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsu.com, mtsunews.com, I should say, and we're also available on iTunes.